To the deeper issues, 96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside Segment, where your questions and comments matter at 202-319-7810. Join the conversation.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Inside Segment. I'm Harold Fisher. There have been several recent high-profile deaths that raise the issue of mental health and illness in the minority community. Comedian Jack Knight committed suicide just last week. He was 28 years old, former Miss USA. Chelsea Christ committed suicide in January. She was 30 years old. This is a Wellness Wednesday conversation, and as we observe National Minority Mental Health Month, we try to address some of the questions around this issue. My guests are Dr. Danielle Hairston, psychiatrist and assistant professor at the Howard University College of Medicine, and Deneen Vaughn, co-founder and CEO of the Mind and Wellness Foundation. She lost her son to suicide. Lines are open. Give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. If you have a comment, if you have a question about this issue. And of course, you can tweet me at HFisherWHUR or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Dr. Hairston, Ms. Vaughn, thank you so much for joining this important conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Sure.
Thank you for having me back, Mr. Fisher.
Absolutely. So, Dr. Hairston, let me start with you, because we are talking specifically about Minority Mental Health Month, but the very name of this observance raises questions. Mm-hmm. Is minority mental health different from other populations that may also experience issues with mental health?
So, first of all, I guess the term minority is even, we have to think about that language, because are we minorities or minoritized or marginalized? But yes, people who do identify as Black and Brown, we do present differently when we have mental health issues. Our depression symptoms might not look the same as our white counterparts. We have gone through generations and generations of trauma that people who are not from our group don't identify with. So they can't understand. They can't understand what it would be like to have a family that had to survive through racism, through enslavement. So, it presents differently. We have different issues. We present our symptoms differently. We're less likely to talk to a psychiatrist. We're more likely to just be seen in crisis. So, yeah, it looks different.
You keep using the term different. Let's drill down a little bit more on that. How might Black and Brown people present differently when compared to their white counterparts? What might we see?
In our groups, we're less likely to come in and say, I'm depressed, I'm unhappy. We might say things like, I'm not feeling like myself, or I'm just feeling tired. We're less likely to say, I'm having difficulties with my mood, but you might see some isolation. You might see some change in how you engage with your family or other social groups. We're more likely to have physical complaints than to complain about things mentally, just because of the way that we've had to be able to survive in this country. So I might say, oh, I'm just tired, I'm just exhausted, I'm overwhelmed, or my nerves are bad, instead of saying that I'm going through anxiety or experiencing depression.
Ms. Vaughn, yes. Talk to me and to our listeners about your son. Who was he? What can you share with us about his life and passing?
Yep. My son, Chris. Chris Vaughn, at the time of his death, is a 30-year-old, obviously Black male, who grew up in a predominantly, they grew up in Northern Virginia. For us, for him, that meant we were just a select few. And when you saw one, you know, you kind of clinged to and kind of grabbed on hold of, oh my gosh, there's another, somebody that looks like me. He was a vibrant, kind of described as the life of the party, and meaning, though, engaged with everyone, very social, very caring, very kind. I knew this about him anyway, but at the time of his death, this outpouring of how he connected and identified, you know, other people and helped be that face of strength for other people, and the place of, short of saying comfort, but a place of that people could just be themselves is what he was striving for too, just to be himself. He was a producer, so he's in the entertainment industry, a very talented photographer, just, I would say, and not being biased, a well-rounded, just young man.
When did you lose him?
I lost him, excuse me, November 1 last year, November 1, 2021.
I would imagine that this came as a shock to you and the family, and that you, and I'm imagining this, but I don't know whether or not there were any signs whatsoever that could have led up to your son taking his life.
So couldn't imagine that he would take his life, that he would lead his life. I talked to him just that morning. I will tell you differently where we he had disclosed where he was having difficulty, where we had saw some signs a couple of years ago, but that was coming out of him suffering from a traumatizing life-changing experience. He was suffering. He had been recently diagnosed months in advance of his death of having post-traumatic stress disorder and depression. But getting to that point where he was comfortable enough, one, to share it, that he was struggling and having difficulty was hard. We have an open, you know, family where we discuss everything, and even with that, the depths of what he was experienced were not expressed. He did see coming out of all that we went through, everybody with COVID, I won't say coming out of it, but, you know, experiencing COVID, the issues with racial matters that we had, just, and you go, there was a lot of things that compounded and I think made it even more difficult for him. But he did not disclose his difficulty with his friends and close people, just people that he felt were close to him, because of concerns of what will other people think, the stigmatization of it. How do I express this? And I don't really even know what I'm experiencing at that given point. I know something's wrong, but I don't know how to pinpoint it.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are observing National Minority Mental Health Month, and we are trying to address the questions around mental illness. If you have a comment, if you have a question, if you're looking for resources, please don't hesitate to give us a call at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Speaking of resources, Dr. Harrison, there is a Howard University mental health related event that you wanted to share with us that those in this region may seek for resources. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. So thank you for bringing that up. This Saturday, July 23rd, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., right in front of our Howard University Hospital, which is, the address is 2041 Georgia Ave Northwest, and the metro station is Shaw Metro, Howard. We will be partnering, the Howard University Hospital is partnering with the American Psychiatric Association to bring mental health providers and vendors who provide services, case management, social workers, prescribers, psychiatrists, everyone, including our own department, will be outside on the front lawn to give information to the community. We'll have Zumba, we'll have mindfulness sessions, we'll have book readings, activities for kids, just everything that you need to think about when we're trying to think about how to approach mental health, how we can help everyone. So there's going to be free food. I know it's going to be hot. I know Mr. Fisher, it's going to be hot out there on Saturday, but we do have cooling stations. We have water. We don't want anyone going into the emergency department, but know that physicians are out there and on site. Our medical students are going to be there as well to help us all along. We just wanted to provide a resource, some support around mental health issues for the community that we serve here in D.C. and the greater Washington area. So you don't need to register. Just walk right up to the hospital. You will see us. You can't miss us on Georgia Ave. Music, Zumba, books for kids, resources, where to go for help. Various agencies across our city will be there to help our community to find resources for treatment and assistance with their mental health concerns.
Okay. That's from 10 to 2 this Saturday at Howard University Hospital. That sounds like a great opportunity to get some resources. It may be a little too hot for Zumba, but...
Slow Zumba. Meditation.
Yeah, let's do the cool down meditation. And you gotta keep it healthy no matter what you're doing, mind, body, and spirit. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking about National Minority Mental Health Month, trying to address some of the questions around this issue. Let's go to Brandon. Brandon calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, Brandon. What's on your mind?
Thank you, sir. Yes, what's on my mind, when you say the people of color, call myself, a male of color, we don't accept so much as being mental depressed or seasonal depressed, manically depressed, because their names seem foreign to us. But we can be in a community of addiction, and we'll call each other bipolar, and those, et cetera, names that deal with mental health. But my question is that why, when the race of Europeans can be labeled after they commit a crime, they can be classed as a mental a person with mental problems, but before they commit the crime, nobody don't speak about the mental problem. But when we do it, nobody don't bring about no mental issues. We are just criminals.
That's a really interesting point, Dr. Harrison, because considering the rise in homicide in our urban centers, D.C., Baltimore, and others, there have been questions raised about what impact mental health, mental illness has or is related to some of these issues that Brandon is bringing up. Your thoughts about that, and then Ms. Vaughn.
Okay.
Go ahead, Dr. Harrison.
It was a little difficult for me to hear.
He was talking about how people of color are less likely to be labeled having mental health issues as opposed to white people who have committed crimes, and then after they commit crimes, the diagnosis is often mental health, but when black people commit crimes, it's just they're called criminals.
Oh, okay. That's definitely something that we've seen come up. And first, we need to recognize that people who have mental illnesses, people who have mental health issues, are actually more likely to be victims of crime and not to be perpetuators of crime. And I think that that's a stigma that the media, sometimes certain people in the government, have perpetuated that, they have a mental illness. We need to keep weapons away from people with mental illnesses. We need to keep weapons away from everyone. And we see that if it happens to be a white shooter or a white killer, then they're given the assumption that, they must have had a mental illness, and they can come through an interaction with the police or alive on the other side. But when we see a black person, they're called a criminal or a killer or a murderer. And that really has not too much to do with the diagnosis, but it's really about how this country socializes mental illness and who it determines has an issue and is a criminal. And this is something that we've seen time and time again. We see a lot of misdiagnosis and also missed diagnosis of people in our communities. But why is it that someone who is black is more likely to be incarcerated for their mental illness than get help. And we see that when it comes to substance use and everything. And that is something that goes along with the policies.
Hold your point, because I've got to take a quick break. Also, I want to hear from Ms. Vaughn as well. Brandon, thank you so much. We're going to take a break. But don't forget, you can hear every edition of the Daily Drum Inside segment via podcast on WHUR.com after 8:30. I'm Harold Fisher. Stretches in for John Mons with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. This conversation continues at 202-319-7810. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to the Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. As we observe National Minority Mental Health Month, we're trying to address some of the questions around mental health and mental illness, particularly as it relates to suicide in the minority community. We continue with Dr. Daniel Hairston, psychiatrist and assistant professor at the Howard University College of Medicine, and Deneen Vaughn, co-founder and CEO of the Mind and Wellness Foundation. We will be taking your calls. Sit tight. I promise that we will be talking to you shortly. And again, as I said, Brandon, thank you so much for contributing to the conversation. Let me let you finish your point, Dr. Hairston. Go right ahead.
Oh, my point was just that this is how every fiber of our country is, you know, and racism is embedded in it. So you're much likely to see a quote-unquote excuse made for a white killer or shooter than you are for a black person. So it's not really about the diagnosis, because they can't say truly, unless they've evaluated someone, that they have a mental illness, or they're given that, allowed that grace, I would say, or allowed that excuse that is not given to members of the black community.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Vaughn, your thoughts about what Brandon was sharing?
I don't know that I have anything more to add than what the doctor is saying. I feel like having three black young men that we've raised, that it's always the bias is there's something wrong, we're criminals, or we're looked at differently. You know, I can't say that any of my guys have been labeled, you know, not knowing what the evaluations are, or that their evaluations even had in the differences of a crime being committed by a white person than a black person. It does always come up, and you always go, huh, when that happens, and you see that the news deflects to that, or however it's portrayed, that this person had a mental illness and this is why this occurred. Mm-hmm. To Brandon's point, though, when it happens in our community, that's the last. They're just labeled a criminal and that seemingly is it. Again, no grace given, no evaluation, opportunity to be evaluated. It's just kind of judgment in society.
One could also argue that as it relates to mass shootings and the lion's share of those mass shootings committed by white males, the recent legislation to help curtail that coming out of Congress deals specifically with mental health issues, which suggests that the issue of guns was not, you know, first of all, not included in that legislation. Only issues related to red flags, mental health, and as I said, the lion's share of those killings attributed to white males, which I think goes to the heart of the point that Brandon was attempting to make, as well as what Dr. Hairston was saying. Ms. Vaughn, talk to me a little bit about the Mind and Wellness Foundation and what you're attempting to do with that.
Absolutely. Again, this foundation only exists, unfortunately, as inspired by Chris's death, by his passing, by his suicide. It was born out of his death, but certainly at the urging and of our family, and then fueled by the outpouring of love and support from others who I think were taken aback by our willingness to be transparent about the fact that he committed suicide, and it wasn't anything other than that, than suicide. Many people said thank you, you know, and just were in awe of the fact that we could be so transparent. I don't know that we could be any other way in terms of his loss. I've seen, unfortunately, three losses of young black males in our community alone by suicide. So, but the Mind and Wellness Foundation attempt, our goal is to help do our part to start having these conversations and eradicate the way in which mental health and mental illness is looked at. We want to change the conversation and the narrative about it. We want to be able to, we say wellness in this, we certainly at the core of this, the reason is mental health, but we want to start looking at ways in which, to the doctor's point, we start being able to take better care of ourselves and look at ourselves and look at ourselves holistically from not just our physical, but our mental as well, and how they are intertwined. And so doing things to not necessarily to improve upon, we want to be able to improve upon our overall well-being and know that we have tools and resources to include our nutrition and the way we take care of ourselves and fitness, the way we manage stress, to be able to address those things so we can all be better served and equipped to be able to address some of those stressors and things. And then lastly, we want to be able to break down the barriers of cost related to therapy for those we might be able to help. I don't want another young person not to be able to get have access to therapy because of the cost, because it's cost prohibitive.
Where can someone find more information about the Mind and Wellness Foundation?
Absolutely. So I have a website. We have a website. It's mindandwellnessfoundation.org. Mm-hmm. We are on IG or Instagram at mindandwellness_foundation. Also on Facebook, The Mind and Wellness Foundation.
Okay. We'll make sure that we post that information, particularly the website, on our website on whur.com, along with this podcast after 8:30. Let me go to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Linda, thanks for hanging on, calling from D.C. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thank you all for being there. I am just wondering if you have some suggestions on how you get a 34-year-old to continue the treatment.
Dr.
At this point, he's refusing treatment. His eating habits is terrible. He's rebuttaling to everything that we say, even when he has his mental health supporter come. He states that he's sleeping and he can't talk while he's sleeping, and so he really gets upset. So I am just trying to see how can we help this person move forward, because to me he's like standing suicide, not eating, no socialization, to himself, mumbling, and so I was looking for some help with that.
Dr. Harrison?
So it depends on where you are. So I don't know if you're in D.C. or Maryland.
She is in D.C.
If you are in D.C., there, the Department of Behavioral...
Dr. Harrison, if you can hold on, I'm going to pull over right now so I can hear you, because I can't hear you.
Okay. Oh. Yeah, we'd appreciate that, because we want you to be safe as you kind of get this this information. Please let us know when you are prepared.
I am ready.
Okay. Dr. Harrison, right. Please go right ahead.
Yes, so the Department of Behavioral Health has a community response team, or a CRT, here in D.C. D.C. is a very patient-directed and patient-liberal jurisdiction, so that means that, unfortunately, even if everyone is concerned, your family members, your friends, your coworkers, unless the person is an acute risk for something that's dangerous, as in suicide, or at risk for, or has homicidal thoughts, you can't really force anyone into care. I try to encourage family members to take the approach of, we really care about you, but this cannot go on. Like, you can't go on like this. Like, this is not safe. Everyone is concerned. And to start from a place of, we really care. But you can call the community response team, also called the mobile crisis team, for the Department of Behavioral Health, and they will come out to where you are. And that's what I recommend for everyone, especially for our Black families. Instead of sometimes calling 911 because we don't know what may happen and who is trained or who is untrained to come and meet you on the scene. So I recommend calling the mobile crisis, and I wish I had had the number ready, but you can just Google community response team for Department of Behavioral Health. They have a phone number, and they can come out and meet you wherever you are in the district.
Also, okay. Linda, thank you so much.
Dr. Harrison, I do have one question. I have taken that approach. We care about you. I have also called the crisis team as individual. However, the crisis team, like you say, will only do it if they're in a position where they're harming each other or harming someone else. So I am just trying to see what I can do. Is there anything else I could do?
Well, I would say that it's important what the crisis team understands and the context. So if you're saying that he is not eating, that he is losing weight, you know, that is a risk. That is a risk. So to present it in that way, like this is a danger to his health. He's not able to sustain like this. We are worried about him. He's not eating. It's at the point that maybe we're worried about malnutrition, like he really needs to be evaluated. So come in with that sense of urgency because especially high-educated patients and family members and community members can sometimes, you know, talk their way out of things when they're...
Exactly, and that's what he does.
So I think it's really important to explain and emphasize the severity of the case and what you're seeing. Like when you're saying that someone is talking to themselves, mumbling to themselves, isolating, ruminating, like they're not eating, like that's when I would be very concerned. And I would emphasize that from the start. Like, I know he might say this, but this person is not eating, has lost a significant amount of weight, seems to be talking to himself. Like, we are very concerned about our safety and his.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, well, those are some different things that I had not thought about that, but I did take him to get a physical, which he didn't return. So the weight loss is still coming off, and what his eating is a bowl of noodles. So
yeah, I would emphasize that. Or another approach is a trusted physician. So even if it's not a psychiatrist or a therapist, but if he trusts his family medicine doctor or internal medicine doctor, or even if you can go back and talk to the pediatrician or someone that you have a connection to who can say, like, you just really need to go in. Just go in and see what they say. Just go and see what they say. And if it's nothing, then you can always come back. But just go in because we are all concerned and you can't go on like this.
Yeah. Oh. Linda, thank you so much.
Okay, and thank you so very much.
Sure, sure, absolutely.
202-319-7810,
202-319-7810. We are talking about mental health, mental illness in the minority community. Of course, we are observing National Minority Mental Health Month as we try to address some of the questions around this issue. I did want to ask you, Dr. Harrison, as you know, the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline has been up and running since last Saturday. Your thoughts about it, and what do you think, this portends for the future of addressing not only suicide but mental health more broadly in the minority community?
My thoughts are I'm optimistic. I hope that it works. I think that it's a good alternative, an excellent alternative to calling the police, who may not be trained in addressing a mental health crisis. They have a different approach. Obviously, they are law enforcement, so they're there for a different reason. I think that being able to start from the beginning, it depends on the call center, like being able to say, okay, we're going to send out crisis response team, or we're going to send out the EMS, or we're going to send the police, but we're also sending the social worker and mobile crisis. And that really varies by your jurisdiction. That varies from county to county, what resources they have and who's prepared. I think that for the very well-prepared jurisdictions, and I would think that I think that D.C. is one of those prepared areas. PG County is also one of those prepared areas that has more resources. They're ready to roll 988 out well. Some others don't have the same resources and don't have, unfortunately, the same opportunities, and it might still revert to you called 988, but they're sending out the police. So I'm optimistic, and I think it's a great alternative, and I think it will save some lives, especially when we're thinking about who's addressing and who's showing up to someone who is in crisis and the experience they have.
I also wanted to ask both of you, and I'll start with, you know, Ms. Vaughn, and I'd like you to follow up, Dr. Hairston. As we look at, you know, some of the difficult examples that I mentioned at the beginning of the program, the former Miss USA, as well as the comedian Jack Knight. Now, in the case of Chesley Crist, her mental health challenges were well documented. She was very, very transparent about depression and, you know, and other issues. But even outside of the black and brown community, we look at Naomi Judd, who also committed suicide, who for years talked about depression and that she was having these, you know, these mental health challenges. Phyllis Hyman, the great songstress, you know, talked about, you know, depression, and one could argue that you could even hear it, you know, in her music. Robin Williams talked about some of his struggles, and yet all of these people, including your beloved son, Ms. Vaughn, you know, they took their own lives, and you said there weren't any immediate signs shortly before he took his own life, but there were some issues that had been brought to the fore years before. What are we supposed to do? You know, we talk about stigma, you know, Ms. Vaughn, and kind of reducing or eliminating stigma. For whom do we eliminate it? Is it for those of us who have or who claim no mental health issues? Or is it for those who do claim to have mental health issues? Should we be concerned about someone who decides to speak up and destigmatize this, and then we say, well, wait a minute, now that this person is talking about it, we need to put them away and put them in a room so that they don't hurt themselves, when the reality is that there are so many people who are living with mental health challenges who never take their own lives.
I'm going to speak from not Chris's voice, but from my own.
Sure.
I, too, suffer from depression and anxiety, and I have for years. I didn't talk about it openly for a long time for just that fear of how are people going to perceive me? What are people going to say? Anybody that did know, they're going to shun you. Family, because family didn't talk about it. You didn't talk about it, at least in my time in my household, as something, as an issue or something, as a true issue. It was, if it wasn't physical, you weren't bleeding out or whatever, you're good, right? You can't see it. It's not possible to exist. I know it to be real. And I came to a point in which, and at a head, something happened to me where I'll just only describe it as having a nervous breakdown, when I had just stuffed away trauma for years and years and years, and it all came flooding back where I had to start facing it. I became more comfortable talking about it with my own immediate family, and at some point a dear friend, when I was comfortable enough to bring it up, they too in turn shared that they too were suffering, you know, from some form of mental illness, and at that point I think it was just depression. But I think the removing the stigma is for not just the person that whole, you know, suffers from the mental illness or believes that they do. It's for others to understand mental illness is real. Mental disorders are real. And to, we can't just, and forgive any audiences listening, you can't just pray it away. It doesn't just go away. It's not about just put a smile on and be optimistic. It needs to be looked at and addressed by a professional. And you got to be willing to get to that, open enough to go, I need help. That said, it goes on top of that. How can I afford it? Does it exist? You know, does therapy exist for me and what I hold in insurance? I don't have insurance. Where do I go? Who do I turn to? Of recent for me in trying to deal with this, the point that came up for me is I wanted somebody that looked like me. It was beyond just having a therapist. I needed to be able to go to someone that could observe my overall and that looked like me. So there was a number of things. Again, speaking for somebody that has depression and anxiety.
Excuse me. I guess, you know, my question, Dr. Hairston, is, and I think Ms. Vaughn brings up a really important point. She said she has suffered from depression and anxiety for years. And, you know, we are very fortunate to have her still with us and the work that she is doing. But there are others who may not, as we know, have had any of these issues. And from the view of someone on the outside, how do we compare a Deneen Vaughn who is constantly working to improve her mental health and using those energies to help others with those who seem fine from the outside and yet have taken their own lives? What do those of us from the out, what are we to think as we try to navigate this issue? How do we know? And how do we help someone who seems perfectly fine until they are gone by their own hand?
So I think it's important that we understand when we're thinking about someone who has died from suicide, it doesn't mean that they have to show up as looking like they're so depressed and they're so unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's important for all of us to understand that, because frequently we'll hear, oh, they look great. They seemed fine. Or I talked to them earlier in the day. But know that they might have been putting up this front, pushing through, quote unquote, pushing through, having this happy face, mm-hmm. trying to stay okay, or quote unquote okay, or maintain normalcy for we don't know how long. Yes. And yes. It's important to know that everyone who dies by suicide does not have depression. Mm-hmm. But there are other mental health issues and illnesses that result in people dying by suicide. Trauma is a big issue. Even people who have schizophrenia might die by suicide. So it's not only presenting with a depressed picture.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess this is the time where what should we do or what are we to think? I think we have to, you know, when something is different. You might know when I haven't heard from this person or I haven't talked to them in a while, or they're not engaging with the group text, or I haven't seen them, or they keep refusing to come to our family get-togethers, or even in the time of COVID now, like they're not joining the Zooms, the family Zooms or talks, or they're not responding to my messages, they won't pick up my call. Like, seriously, take a step and say, I'm not trying to call you out. I'm just trying to call you in here. Like, do you need some additional help? Like, is there something else that's going on? It's about, yes, checking on your strong friends, but checking on your all friends, especially for us in the Black community where there is so much stigma for many reasons about reaching out for help and talking about your issues.
Hmm. I'll just add on top of that, as you did things I kept saying when resignating, one of the things Chris didn't present beyond he was that person to put on that mask. The letter he wrote us, the last couple of lines, just resonated in our kind of the core of where we're operating from. And they include, he said, listen and take care of each other, but really listen, it's resonated, and check in on your quote-unquote strong people. And he was one of those that would, you outside of what he was going through, he never was, he presented. I was talking to him that morning. I was talking to him the night before. He was on the Zoom call, I think. So I'm just kind of going along with what doctor has said, is that they don't always show up as having depression or any real signs, but.
And you, I think you make a really salient point, Dr. Hairston, particularly for people in high-profile positions. I use the example of Jack Knight, who's a comedian, Robin Williams, a comedian, people whose outward appearance was professionally, personally, consistently about making others laugh. One could argue making others happy. And it juxtaposed with what was really going on inside. And this is so complex because, as you just said, this isn't always about depression. It's not always about anxiety. It could be about chemical imbalance. It could be about trauma. It could be about schizophrenia. It could be about so many issues. And I guess, you know, what signs do people often miss? And you spoke about when you were talking to the caller, and you gave some really great, great points for people who are right there with, for example, a family member. And also, when you're talking about people who may be absent all of a sudden when they weren't before, because the first thing that comes to mind, you know, for me is that, yeah, you know, I've got some great, you know, sister friends and some great friends, and all of a sudden I don't hear from them, and I call you and I'm like, so, you know, hey girl, you okay? What happened? Yeah, I got a boyfriend. I'm not talking to you as much. I don't need you. I mean, it's funny, but that's true. You know, your girlfriends, your single girlfriends who are always, you know, going to brunch and going to drinks with you, all of a sudden they got a man, they disappear. You know, the single guy friends, you know, they get a new girlfriend, they're not hanging out at the basketball court. But if you can eliminate those kinds of life moments and dig a little deeper, you may discover that there may be some other things. A personal example, I lost my father back in May. I prepared for that as much as I could. I have my moments. Doesn't bother me at work. Got too much stuff going on at work to have a moment. But in those quiet, you know, hours, there may be mourning, no depression, no anxiety, but I lost my dad. Those moments may be fleeting, 30 seconds, sometimes 2 or 3 minutes. And I may be a little more quiet. I don't know, Harold Fisher and quiet, that doesn't make sense. But I am less talkative. But, you know, I would say I'm okay. But again, Dr. Hairston, how do my friends know that I'm really okay when they call me and I say I'm fine? How can they dig, you know? How do they know that I'm truly fine?
Well, you know, let me say I'm sorry to hear about the loss of your father.
Thank you. I appreciate that. My dad was kind of cool. I really liked him a lot.
Well, I'm sure that he's with you. I've also lost my father, so I understand. But I just want to be very clear. That
real quick, because I've got about a minute.
Yeah, so much responsibility on the friends and the family. Like, you can do your check-in. You can do your check-in, you can do the text, you can do your drive-bys and drive-throughs and run up on them. And sometimes they just don't want you to know and they just can't voice that. Yeah. So I don't want it to seem like, for people to live with regret forever and think like, what could I have done? Because we see that a lot. And then we see like then the family members going through issues of feeling like they are worthless and their own guilt and their own depression. Like, sometimes you just don't know, and sometimes that's the way it is. But you can do your best to do those check-ins, but don't take on so much of the responsibility and accountability. Sometimes it's just too hard to reach someone, and that's when it's time for the professionals. And if they don't get that help, then I don't want family members and friends and colleagues to feel like, well, I let them down.
I think that's a good place to end this conversation. Dr. Danielle Harrison, thank you so much for sharing your insight and expertise. Deneen Vaughn, our condolences on the loss of your son, but there is light in the foundation that you and your family have created, and I wish you all the success. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Sure. That is the Daily Drum for this Wednesday, July 20th. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.